Good evening. Mayor Bill de Blasio says the city is on track to begin a phased reopening in June. The governor has his doubts, though. Activists ask the city council to defund the NYPD, and China plays the long game. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Urienzo with the news for Thursday, May 21st, 2020. And New York City is on track to begin its phased reopening, including opening retail stores with modifications and construction jobs as the number of hospitalizations related to COVID-19 continue to decline. That's according to Mayor Bill de Blasio today.
Here's something amazing. For more than a week, we have been around or even below the annual average for folks admitted to hospitals for this broad kind of disease. This is very powerful. It means that when you think about where we are now, not where we were a week, two, three, 4 weeks ago, but where we are now, because of your amazing work, we've brought this down far enough that it actually resembles a typical year for this broad category of diseases. So that's a very important fact. And that's now been going on for more than a week. On that third indicator, the percent of people testing positive citywide. Again, you see a little fluctuation. You saw a little bit of fluctuation today. We've had several days in single digits, which we obviously didn't see before. But here's another big picture reality. The last 10 days have all been below 15%. So even though we see some fluctuation on the big picture, something very important has happened. We've gotten down below 15% for 10 days and stayed there consistently. So again, this is remarkable progress. I'm going to go into more and more detail starting tomorrow and the days ahead about how we are taking this information and now using it to prepare for the steps we'll take in June and what we're looking for as we make our final decisions on restart and then how to sustain a safe restart. And again, we're talking about small, smart steps. It will take a series of steps over time to get back to anything like normal. But something very good is happening because of your hard work, and everyone in this town should feel good about that.
But a cautious Governor Andrew Cuomo, while agreeing he and the mayor are on the same page, says he's not ready to make a definitive statement.
Yeah, I don't think we're on a different page at all on schools and reopening. My position is I don't have a position. I don't know whether or not they should reopen yet. We're getting more information, we're getting more data, and we'll make a decision on the full reopening in a timely way. We're telling them, go ahead, do your plans, tell me how you would take a classroom, reduce the density, tell me how you would reduce density on a school bus, tell me how you would reduce density in a cafeteria setting, etc. Give us those plans by July, and then we have to make a decision about September. But I don't think there's a difference of opinion or position between the state and the city.
And while de Blasio has stated summer school by way of distance learning is on, the governor says he's not so sure. Speaking about summer camps, Cuomo said, be careful.
New set of facts. Children are not affected. Okay. Let's see what we do about camps. Let's see what we do about school. Hold on. Children may be affected. This inflammatory syndrome is more frightening than COVID respiratory illness in some ways because it inflames the heart. Well, we know it exists. We don't know how widespread it is. But the more we look, the more we find it. And in 1 week, we double the number of countries who now found it, and we double the number of states. What do you do about summer camps? I say, have the same conversation with our health experts. I say, let's put it this way. I want to send my children to day camp. Should I send my children to day camp? Is it safe? Until we have this answer on this pediatric syndrome, as a parent, until I know how widespread this is, I would not send my children to day camp. And if I won't send my children to day camp, I wouldn't ask anybody else to send their children to day camp. It's that simple.
Part of the problem is creeping lockdown fatigue. The MTA says riders have begun returning to the subways and buses despite the lockdown. Bus ridership has been nearly doubled from a recent low of 400,000 riders a day to 700,000 now. And subway ridership has edged up from 400,000 to 600,000. That's according to the MTA. The subway system is still closed at night. COVID-19 has hit the MTA particularly hard. At least 123 transit workers have been killed in the pandemic, which has taken the lives of more than 20,000 New Yorkers. As the number of COVID cases seems to be declining, at least for now, the state and city are turning to the economic carnage caused by months of lockdown. The Independent Budget Office predicts the city will see $9.5 billion in combined tax revenue shortfalls this fiscal year and next. To address the shortfalls, de Blasio has already proposed $2.7 billion in budget cuts. The cuts have hit countless social programs and projects affecting everything from homeless services to anti-violence initiatives. Today, activists joined more than 360 persons who signed up to testify on the mayor's interim budget for the City Council Finance Committee. The issue that came up again and again was a lack of cuts to the $6 billion NYPD budget.
My name is Antonine Pierre, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Brooklyn Movement Center. I am speaking today on behalf of Communities United for Police Reform, taking the place of Juhan Kang. The deep inequalities that existed in our city before COVID-19 have been starkly revealed and exacerbated by the pandemic. The mayor's proposed FY21 budget is unacceptable. It would be devastating to communities of color and all New Yorkers. We are calling on the City Council to reject the immoral priorities laid out in the executive budget and to pass a budget that will truly ensure an equitable recovery for Black, Latinx, and other communities of color most devastated by all impacts of the pandemic. As you know, the executive budget includes many cuts to social services. However, the NYPD budget has been left essentially untouched with less than half of 1% of cuts proposed. We are calling on you to ensure that the FY21 budget makes significant cuts to the NYPD's bloated almost $6 billion budget. These cuts should include a hiring freeze on the NYPD, including school safety officers, the cancellation of cadet classes to stop the expansion of the NYPD into social service delivery, and cuts to protect New Yorkers from abusive policing, as well as cuts to non-essential items in the NYPD budget. Budgets are roadmaps to a government's priorities and morals. We need an FY21 budget that puts major financial resources into our public health infrastructure, social safety net, and programs that will enable our communities to not only survive, but thrive through and after the pandemic. The only way to do this requires the council to be willing to reduce the NYPD's massive, non-transparent, and unaccountable budget as a part of an overall budget justice strategy. So in closing, please feel free to reach out to Brooklyn Movement Center, Communities United for Police Reform, and member groups who would love to partner with council members to fight for a budget our communities deserve, and use the hashtag NYC Budget Justice.
Good afternoon, Chair Drum and other council members. My name is Leo Ferguson, and I am on staff at Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. I'm testifying on behalf of the NYC Against Hate Coalition, which is seeking a restoration and expansion of funding through the Hate Violence Prevention Initiative. The Hate Violence Prevention Initiative, the Office for the Prevention of Hate Crimes at MACJ, and the NYC Against Hate Coalition were created last year and funded by this council in response to rapidly rising hate violence in New York City. Unfortunately, the city has overemphasized the NYPD Hate Crimes Task Force and prosecutions. Which is a response to symptoms, not underlying causes, and does not educate, heal, or unite communities. The Hate Violence Prevention Initiative is a step in the right direction, a better direction, that empowers directly impacted New Yorkers with trusted, community-based organizations innovating rigorous, effective strategies. We strongly support preserving and expanding the initiative and fully funding the Office for the Prevention of Hate Crimes. Given the city's fiscal crisis, we believe it is appropriate and responsible to reduce the budget of the NYPD in order to fund HVPI and OPHC. Even as crime rates plummet, New York City is spending more on policing than on health, homeless services, youth development, and workforce development combined. That simply does not make sense. during a humanitarian and public health disaster. Overinvestment in policing and underinvestment in public health, housing, and communities will only increase the painful inequities that the COVID-19 crisis has laid bare, inequities that fuel intercommunal tensions and drive hate violence. We need a fair budget that protects our frontline and essential workers, begins to address the horrifying racial inequities responsible for Black and brown people dying of COVID at twice the rate of other New Yorkers, that gets homeless people into hotels and supports our kids over the summer and our teachers in the fall. The mayor's budget literally takes services away from the most vulnerable New Yorkers to fund the largest police force in the U.S., cutting the NYPD budget to fund community-based hate violence prevention and other vital, crucial services is the right choice.
The city would get $17 billion in federal stimulus aid under a proposal passed by the Democrat-led House of Representatives on Friday, though the plan is opposed by Republicans. And in more local news, a 27-year-old off-duty police officer was charged with second-degree murder in the shooting death of a childhood friend in Farmingdale, Long Island. The victim was Christopher Curro, 25, of West Babylon. The officer, Eric Allen, is expected to be arraigned today. Attorney General Letitia James has taken over prosecuting the case as a special prosecutor. Allen shot Curro in the head on May 12th. Nassau County Police say the altercation started with a conversation that escalated into an argument. Allen was hired by the NYPD in 2019. He was suspended without pay after the shooting. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And the fixer is free to sing. Michael Cohen, former personal attorney to President Donald Trump, walked out of federal prison in upstate New York today. He promised reporters he'll eventually be telling tales on his old boss. Cohen, 53, wasn't supposed to get out until November 2021 at the earliest. The Justice Department is letting hundreds of inmates convicted of nonviolent crimes do their time at home confinement to slow the spread of coronavirus. The virus has infected at least 14 inmates and guards at the facility in Otisville, New York that housed Cohen. Cohen told Congress last year Trump has committed crimes since taking office, including fraud. He called on lawmakers to hunt down Trump's tax returns, where Cohen says they'll find the proof. And Trump spoke to auto workers in Michigan today, despite not wearing a mask as he had been asked, just a day after he threatened to cut funds to Michigan and other states unless they hastened the return to work in the face of the state's increasing COVID-19 caseload and ballooning deaths due to the coronavirus. Before he left for Michigan, Trump addressed another threat to unilaterally pull out of the Open Skies Treaty passed in 2002, allowing overflights of the U.S. by Russia and of Russia by the U.S. to keep tabs on each country's military. A trust-building measure, Trump said opting out of the treaty would not bar relations or not harm relations with Russia.
So, again, our relationship with Russia has improved greatly, especially since the Russian hoax has been proven totally false and illegal what they did. This was an illegal hoax, and they got caught. They got caught doing a lot of bad things, so let's see how that turns out. But our relationship with Russia's come a long way in the last few months. I think that the open sky will all work out. But right now, when you have an agreement and the other side doesn't adhere to the agreement, we're not going to adhere to it either. But I think something very positive will work out.
Little known to Americans is that both Russia and the United States have for years allowed inspectors from both countries to observe their most important nuclear weapons facilities. Both countries actually operate labs nearby each other's nuclear sites. But some of the most disturbing developments may not be with Russia, except for its nuclear armaments, a much weaker nation than America, but with China, a country fast becoming this country's economic equal. Today, China says it's going over the head of the government of Hong Kong to impose new security measures that have sparked a crackdown on young democracy activists. James Bradley is author of several New York Times bestsellers, including Flags of Our Fathers, the story of the raising of the United States flag at Iwo Jima during World War II, that became a blockbuster movie produced by Clint Eastwood and Steven Spielberg. Bradley spoke with WBAI from his home in New Zealand.
In World War II, China was like a little son. It was a little boy who was going to follow us. At least that was the imagery that Franklin Roosevelt, Pearl Buck, Henry Luce with Time magazine put across. And then America was very disappointed when a guy in pajamas, Mao Zedong, rose up and China didn't become Christian and Americanized. and we didn't like it, and we broke off relations. It's very different right now. You have the world's two leading economies. We were not economic competitors before. And on my website, untoldpacific.com, I'm interviewing a number of experts really clued in who say that we are at war. If you look at war in different means, kinetic war, satellite war, trade war, currency war, and it could lead to war, but it doesn't have to.
China and the United States seem to find a place in the world where they helped each other.
I'm not trying to sell my last book, but the name of it is The China Mirage. And I put the mirage because America generally is looking to a mirage and not the reality on China. And the mirage here, you can hear it over and over and over in media interviews, American experts saying, gee, we opened up, we thought China would liberalize, we gave them a chance, and oh my God, they're not little Democrats like we wanted them to be. What happened? That was a mirage. China is not malevolent, it's just China. There's an emperor system, you know, and the emperor is now a bunch of guys on a committee, and China will be China. And America has difficulty with that. Look at, we're number one, China's number two, let's say economically. They're number, you know, whatever the measurements are. My case is, yes, this is natural that 1.4 billion people might have an economy larger than 330 million people. We could be a strong number two. Maybe America can double the size of its economy, double our wealth in a number two slot. China for thousands of years was the most dominant economic power in the world. They're not a third world country rising. They are a first world country just getting back into their lane.
Well, the United States is the United States, and they don't brook well with anybody else in the world being above them. So how can we avoid conflict?
It seems like we're not. I don't get it. I mean, what, you know, what is number one? Our number oneness is only recent, and it's changing. There's two balloons, and they're very large balloons, and they're in an enclosed room, and they're bumping up against each other, and there could be conflict. My plea, my case, is that there's a rickety bridge of understanding across the Pacific. You know, for 100 years, a guy like you and me couldn't know a Chinese. They couldn't live next door. We had the Chinese Exclusion Act. So, and then when Mao came to power, what did we do? We fired everybody in the State Department who spoke Chinese. That's how horrible the Chinese were. Just eviscerate the American government. Anyone who spoke Chinese or knew Mao Zedong, and we went through McCarthyism, it's a new day. I'm sorry. Maybe you don't get along with your spouse right now, but you live in the same house and you got to work something out. There's some way we can come to understandings without fighting.
What about Hong Kong?
The emperor has a long view. And if we look at like what happened yesterday or today, and they're looking at thousands of years past and thousands of years future. Hong Kong's part of China. The British got it when the British had the military boot on the Chinese throat. It was involved in the Opium Wars. Just look at Taiwan and Hong Kong and think this is a temporary thing that, you know, we don't have full control. Maybe we have to wait another 100 years, but it's part of China. A guy like me, a Westerner, you know, is thinking about this month and tensions. And The emperor's thinking of hundreds of years of, at some point, folding Taiwan into the Chinese fold. It's not something they have to do next month or next year or do militarily. Looking thousands of years back and thousands of years forward, they do see Taiwan as part of China.
Sounds like Vietnam, the Vietnam War situation, and what defeated America in Vietnam.
What has been the problem in the South China Sea? John McCain flew off aircraft carriers in the South China Sea. I've interviewed hundreds of people in Vietnam who got bombed from the South. The Vietnam War killed about 3 million Southeast Asians. China hasn't done that, and China wants that South Sea area open as their highway. You Americans have Highway 95 or Highway 1 on the West Coast. Or you've got the Caribbean, and the Chinese are not in San Francisco Bay, and they don't want Americans or anybody else in the South China Sea.
Usually at the end of an interview like this, is a wonderful interview, I say, well, how do you sum things up? How do we sum up the next 1,000 years?
The next 1,000 years is that there's a planet and there's a lot of people, and we can fight it out or work it out. I'm advocating that we work it out.
James Bradley is author of Flags of Our Fathers, Flyboys, and The China Mirage, among other New York Times bestsellers. He spoke with WBAI from New Zealand. And finally, the firing of the Inspector General of the State Department has focused attention on the activities of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The IG had reportedly asked to interview Pompeo shortly before he was fired by President Trump, who says he was asked to fire Stephen Link by Pompeo. Reportedly, Pompeo had been hosting lavish dinners with potential campaign supporters, all on the taxpayer dime. Pompeo has made no secret he might run for a Senate seat in Kansas. But possibly more disturbing is that Link was looking into Pompeo's role in an end run around Congress in order to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, an arms sale that would benefit the Raytheon Corporation, a major defense contractor that Secretary of Defense Mark Esper was at one time a former top official of Raytheon. Bill Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. He says Raytheon's bombs have been killing civilians in Yemen as part of a civil war being fanned by Saudi Arabia.
I think in terms of arms to Saudi Arabia, like the bombs they're using in Yemen, for Donald Trump, it's just business. He wants Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing to earn as much as possible selling to Saudi Arabia and other countries. And Raytheon has sort of penetrated the administration in terms of lobbying. They've got the Secretary of Defense as a former lobbyist of theirs, who was a legal advisor in the State Department, who helped push through some arms sales last year. And they work closely with the White House trade advisor, Peter Navarro, who's been advocating for them. The CEO has become friends with Trump. It seems to be about the money. Every once in a while they say, oh, it's about Iran, it's about the Iranian threat and so forth, but that doesn't seem to be what's driving it.
How can you tell that?
For example, when they declared an emergency last year to ram some arms sales to Saudi Arabia through the Congress, and when they wrote up the emergency declaration, they said it was about dealing with the threat from Iran. But they had briefed Congress just 3 days earlier. They said nothing about needing to sell arms to Saudi Arabia because of Iran. Whereas all through that time, they were getting this pressure from Raytheon and their allies to move ahead. And with Trump, they were pushing on an open door because he used arms sales as a way to get jobs, to get popular, to get himself reelected and so forth.
Is this unusual? I mean, you've been following this kind of thing for a long time, Bill. And is this unusual for presidents to be so blatant?
Most presidents are mindful that there's jobs involved in arms sales, may even talk about it a bit. But Trump is yelling it from the rooftops. It seems to really overwhelm any other consideration, which I think Saudi Arabia is a good example of that, because here's the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Raytheon bombs have been used to hit funerals, weddings, marketplaces. A U.S. bomb hit a school bus. Even some Republicans in Congress put their foot down about this. And even after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi U.S. resident journalist, Trump wasn't budging. He made a statement getting off Air Force One that there were millions of jobs involved in selling to Saudi Arabia, when in fact there might be 20 to 40,000. So he's kind of unhinged on this issue. He's kind of created his own little fantasy world.
I don't almost know what to ask next. China looks at things, and I'm skipping to China, but it seems to be another one of his obsessions. China, they look at things in the Asian world in terms of 1,000 years, and Trump thinks in terms of like yesterday or 5 minutes from now. Strategically, what do you think this is going to head? Is this going to lead us to a war, or is this just going to lead us to another disaster?
Trump's antipathy towards China is, again, it's kind of driven, I think, by what he thinks is going to make him popular. He's going to posture as a tough guy. He's going to stand up to the Chinese threat. He's already trying to say that, you know, China wants Biden because Biden is soft on China. Problem with that kind of thing is it can get out of hand. He starts a trade war, you do a buildup in the Pacific, the rhetoric is flying. The thing that's holding us back is that they're both nuclear-armed powers, and so World War III is not something anybody wants, probably even Donald Trump. His erratic behavior, his rhetoric, the fact that he doesn't think two moves ahead, all of that makes the world a more dangerous place.
Raytheon, what kind of company is Raytheon?
Well, Raytheon now is almost entirely involved in building weaponry. So they make all kinds of tactical missiles that fly in airplanes. They make precision-guided munitions of the kind that have been used in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. They make missile defense systems. They're about the third largest company in terms of benefiting from weapons exports. It's a big part of their business. Probably have more influence over this administration than any other defense contractor. When your former chief lobbyist is Secretary of Defense, you're sitting pretty when it comes to influencing the government.
Bill Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. And that's some of the news for Thursday, May 21st, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Walter Yenzo.